You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of March 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, the most anticipated day of the US primary season has arrived. This Super Tuesday frontrunners Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are hoping to wipe out their rivals. I'll discuss with my guests, Kathleen Burke and John Everard, how likely that is, as well as the other day's top stories, which include the ugly turn of events of the migrant crisis in Europe as tear gas is used in both Calais and at the Greek-Macedonian border. Then the future of the shaky truce in Syria, as the country's main opposition warns that the attempts to halt nearly 5 years of fighting is in danger of collapse because of attacks by government forces. And who's guilty in the first ever traffic accident for a driverless car? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House, and my guests today are Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, and the former British diplomat, John Everard. Welcome both to the programme. Now, the most anticipated day of the US primary season has finally arrived. This Super Tuesday, 12 states and one territory make decisions on who they'll back to become their candidate for the next president. On the Republican side, Donald Trump is favoured in nearly every Super Tuesday state based on early polling. Hillary Clinton's early polling numbers are also favourable, and the numbers show her with leads in nearly every state too. Kathleen, is it a kind of a done deal on both sides, do you think?
Well, fortunately for those of us who are dead keen on this sort of thing, not entirely. Texas is an interesting example because Cruz might well take that, and because about it has a huge number of delegates. If he does, that will put a bit of a hole in the total expected by Trump. So I think we have to look at Texas and see what happens. That I think is going to be vitally important. Again, we have to look at the turnout, I think, and the question and the turnout and what ages turn out, if masses of middle-aged women and people of color vote, one can assume that Hillary Clinton's going to do better. If they're a lot younger, more likely Bernie Sanders. So we all expect, yes, as you said, Trump and Clinton, but not going to the stake on it.
But Kathy, just on this, it does look like the Bernie Sanders bus stops here kind of thing, doesn't it? He's going to find it hard to keep up any momentum. It looks like it's so many states. You know, he's quite good in white working class northern states, but here you have these very diverse states with, as you say, people of colour, a much more kind of mixed set of voters. He just seems very unlikely to win them.
Except that, yeah, well, I mean, almost certainly you're right. But remember that a lot of Hillary Clinton's support comes from the urban areas. And Midwest and the South have an awful lot of rural areas. Who knows? I mean, a lot of them may not like Clinton. So, yes. But think how much money Bernie Sanders is still managing to raise. He raised more than Clinton did in January, for example. So if he's got the money to keep going, he may well. Of course, the difficulty that one doesn't always remember in all of these primary states are the thresholds. In Arkansas and Oklahoma, unless you get at least 15% of the votes in the Republican, you don't get any delegates at all. The others, you have to have a 20% barrier. So it depends, for example, in the Republicans in particular, if they don't get over that barrier, it doesn't matter if they have 19% of the votes, they won't get any delegates. So I think what I'm trying to say is that many of these states, almost none of them are winner-take-all. And so it depends on the congressional districts, it depends on getting out the vote, it depends on the demographics. This is a most astonishingly unpredictable. And also, of course, you think, oh, my God, this can't really be happening.
It looks like it'll be kind of the early hours of this morning when we get the first results here in Europe. John, on the Trump side, what is fascinating is, you know, that any hope of really stopping him involves either Cruz or Rubio stepping back from the from the plate, and neither of them are going to want to do it. As we've just heard, if Cruz takes Texas, he'll say, okay, I've won one of the only states, one of the biggest states, one of the most important states in America. I'm going to stay in the race. And if Rubio does kind of well in middling and all the other ones, he's going to say, and I'm not giving in either. But that's the only way for the people who hope that Trump will not make it to the presidency to kind of trip him up at this stage.
Yes, I think broadly that's right. But there's another dynamic of work here as well. I mean, I tend to share your doubt that Bernie Sanders' stay in power after Super Tuesday is going to be great. Kathleen's quite right to point out he's still reeling the money in, but whether he's still going to pull in that money after the results of today's polls come through, well, let's see. Now, if Bernie Sanders is forced to retire, then, I mean, Hillary Clinton effectively has got the Democratic nomination and can afford to effectively start the presidential campaign, while the Republicans, all the three of them that are likely to be left after Super Tuesday, are still fighting amongst themselves and fighting in a particularly vicious way, and they're all digging up dirt on each other. And I think the damage that the Republican Party is doing to itself in the campaign is likely to be fatal. I mean, you know, it becomes almost not quite irrelevant whether you know, Trump's rivals sort of pull one over him, but effectively what the Republicans are going to be fighting over is who loses against Hillary Clinton.
Kathy.
One point I would like to make in terms of Bernie Sanders, as well as the runners-up and the Republican, the proportion of delegates does mean a certain amount of power at the convention in drawing up what we would, you know, what they call the platform, what we would call the manifesto over here. Mm. And that can be actually really fought over. I mean, that seems to be important. They don't ever feel they have to implement it. But going the platform that you go to the election with is seen as being vitally important, and if Sanders has a lot of delegate votes, even if they're nowhere near enough, that is going to reflect his support in the country, and the manifesto writers, the platform writers, are going to have to reflect that as well.
Yeah. Interesting. The New York Times had a big piece today saying already the Clinton camp is focusing on how do you defeat Trump. Mm-hmm. It feels like they've already moved on from the Bernie Sanders question. And for them, is the question a similar one that's happening in Europe, is how do you connect with, you know, a working class voter who oddly finds perhaps, you know, even people of colour, some people are finding Mr. Trump appealing because he's outspoken, he's maverick, he seems anti-system, he kind of, you know, he speaks to the southern vote in the sense, you know, it doesn't feel like it's, you know, a vote for old school government. Is that the thing that will be worrying Hillary, either of you?
I think quite a lot of Hillary's attempts over the last few weeks to remind the world that she, in her youth, was radical, a campaigner, did all the other kind of outreach stuff, is partially her response to that very question. Now, that she is trying to pull some of the feathers out of Bernie Sanders, and so that, you know, he's now presenting himself as the anti-establishment figure. That's what she has been, she's claiming, for a lot of her career. Whether it's going to work, well, let's see.
The other thing about Hillary Clinton, of course, what she's doing more than Trump does, Trump says, let's all hate together. You know, put the guns around the border, and people are appalling, and most people don't like people, and let's say it because it's all right. Clinton will go far, I think, if she makes a more positive Reagan-type approach. I mean, she's already starting to do that. And if she actually draws a gulf even wider between the two of them, you know, what is an American? An American isn't someone who hates, for example. American is someone who's optimistic and nice to people, and that's why Americans have been popular and so forth. One can imagine the speech she can come up with, and I think that's going to be crucial if she makes people feel good about themselves instead of making people feel good about themselves because they can hate openly.
Do you think she'd quite like to stand against Trump rather than the other two candidates, Rubio and Cruz? Because you know, in a way, if for her, he's a bit of an easier target in some senses. Kathy.
Well, I think she would be happy with either Trump or Cruz. I think she'd feel she had more of a problem with Rubio, even though he hardly is out of short pants yet.
And John, do you think there's a question here? Also, you know, her being a female candidate, I wonder, actually, when it came down to the final two, whether, you know, the crudeness and the kind of antagonism that has been felt by many from Trump against kind of women who have spoken, who have stood up against him in this stage, whether that would kind of undo him a little bit when it was on a really national stage, whether he would be able to hold himself back. Because you get the feeling that actually, when it comes down to it, I don't think women really want to be treated in the way that he speaks to women.
Yes, I think that is probably right.
Well, perceptive.
He still has a lot of women backers, so I can't claim that it's kind of universal. But you know, you just feel that when it gets to the important stage, maybe those tricks won't work in the same way.
No, and I think if President Clinton can reach out and do a kind of sister's speech, you know, try to point out that voting, if you are a woman, that you know, there are certain negatives in voting for Donald Trump, that could probably hit Trump below the waterline. She hasn't done that yet. I mean, she's clearly planned her campaign very carefully.
Because it's not necessarily good to be the woman's candidate, because that ghettoizes you already.
Yeah.
And it also, in a sense, says it's not quite as important as, you know, crisis or fight or something. You see what I mean? I think that would be, she has to appeal to women, but I think she cannot be classified as the woman candidate.
No, that's right. There's a balance to be struck.
Now, we're going to cross over to the other side of the Atlantic, to this side of the Atlantic, where the ongoing migrant and refugee crisis in Europe has been getting uglier week by week. EU leaders are now preparing for an emergency migration summit with Turkey on Monday against the backdrop of desperate scenes at the Greek-Macedonian border. Crowds of migrants were beaten back there after trying to storm a fence, and then there was a follow-up with a salvo of tear gas from the Macedonian side. Now, tear gas was also used in Calais, where French authorities have continued to clear the southern part of the migrant camp known as the jungle. Clashes with police broke out yesterday when the work began and migrants hurled stones at the demolition squads. John, where are we going on this story?
I don't think anybody knows, and I doubt if the summit on Monday is going to answer that question. I mean, the fundamental problem is, of course, everybody can work out where these migrants shouldn't be. Nobody really knows where they should be, and everybody thinks that where they should be somewhere else other than the national territory. And it's all really getting very untidy. It's hard to believe that just a year ago we were sitting around this studio engaging in a sober debate about whether these were migrants or refugees. Remember that? Mm. How the mood has changed since. One of the things that really struck me, we looked at two newspaper articles preparing for this interview, was if you look at the comments on both articles, there's hardly anybody who is in favour of the migrants. Some of the comments are really, really harsh. You know, send them all back.
Yesterday I was looking at the Guardian, a very a left to centre newspaper, and you know this is the problem if you host these debates and these comments. But you got to the end of the story, and the comments were shoot them. Fire a round of live bullets. You know, that will scare them off. If these people were in grey uniforms, we'd be calling this an invasion of Europe. You know, it was some of the harshest comments you can imagine. And I'm sure that The Guardian was quickly trying to delete many of them. But they weren't nuanced. They were, there were comments you could see on any far-right newspaper. And I imagine that some of them were being posted from the region by the nature of the English. But it just strikes you, as you say, Catherine, has the sympathy, it may have left the room some time ago, but has the sympathy really kind of dissipated to almost nothing now?
I think Cologne was a turning point. I think that's when the group of refugees, to many people, became threatening crowd, uncontrollable, a different culture, that it was quite all right to go groping women and so forth. What made it so alien to many people, especially, and I know Cologne quite well, and it was stunned, I think turned them from fellow people who deserve our help to an alien group of which we're not quite sure whether we want them or not, but quite possibly not, because they can't be controlled, they can't be understood, you don't know what to do with them, and there's too many of them.
Yeah, and part of the tragedy is, of course, as we saw in Calais, that the incomprehension and the suspicion is mutual. Mm. I said just now that nobody's entirely sure where to put these people. In Calais, they do have an answer. There are reasonable accommodation blocks. They're converted containers for them, but they're a great deal better than what they're living in the moon. But they don't want to go there because the migrants think this is a trap. And the fact that you have to do a hand scan before you enter or leave these blocks, it seems to have convinced them that this is some form of police apparatus, and that there's
or they'll be forced to claim refugee status in France, and they want to come to the UK. That's why the majority of them are sitting in Calais. I wonder, Cathy, do you when you watch this story, I wonder whether people's, it's not their sympathy that has vanished, it's that they've got a bit confused by the narrative. You know, when we saw the story break last summer, when Angela Merkel said, come, we will look after the refugees from Syria, there was a kind of a simple narrative of families coming up here with their kids, they'd been bombed in Aleppo. But now when we see people interviewed in the camps, it's, you know, it's a large number of people from Afghanistan, from Iran, from Iraq, from Albania, from all across the region. And I think that's what's confusing people. You know, they don't have a simple story anymore. They don't think, okay, we're opening our homes and taking in, you know, refugee kids, and it's a little bit like the, you know, the Kinder transport. They just don't know what the narrative is anymore. What is the end game here? Are we saying that anybody who wants to come up, you should be allowed to come? Are we saying, no, stop? They just don't know what the narrative is now.
Well, it seems to be that if you're starving, that means you're an economic migrant and you can't come. If you're being shot at, that means you're in danger and you can. Seems to be the differentiation that's trying to be made. You can't come if you're from the Balkans because you're safe, even if you're hungry. You can come from Syria because you aren't safe, by definition. You can't be safe, and therefore we'll let in the Syrians. Iraqis are still Syrians and Iraqis, but interestingly, Afghans are now seen as coming from a safe country, and they're not supposed to be allowed in. Balkans are out of the question, of course, and I'm not quite sure what's happened to North Africans. South Saharan Africans, you don't actually hear about them anymore. You don't hear about people from Somalia and Sudan and whatever, but presumably they are someplace because they're coming in great, great numbers.
John, again, before we move on, the last kind of, you know, element on this, I wonder whether also there's a kind of a press failure, or it's more interesting to see what happens as the story moves on. Again, in the summer when we saw all this being reported, you know, the journalists were going to the train stations, they were meeting individual families, they were telling the story of X and Y as they tried to find a place, and as their personal journeys came to an end. Now when the numbers are a million, it's very hard to tell individual stories, and instead, you know, as Kathy says, it's seen as a mass, a huge kind of invading army. All these terms are used, and in a way, it's a failure. If we want to understand what's going on, we need to kind of, you know, take a step back and tell more individual stories, because that is the only way there will be ever any empathy with these people.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, there are people involved in this. And I think that the loss of that perspective has really sort of slanted the debate. It's very telling that almost all the reporting on what's going on in Calais has been from the official side. Lots of statements by the French préfet and by the police. I couldn't find one from any of the asylum seekers. I think there's one sort of pro-asylum NGO that put out a statement of some kind, but almost nothing from the other side. You're right, it's unbalanced.
Photographers try. I mean, think of the stories on the newspaper headlines or front pages when about the Macedonian gas showed a little girl, you know, in a stocking cap coughing from the tear gas. And that made a point that a whole article wouldn't have made. So look at the photographers for it, I suppose.
Just to make a final point, one thing that really has struck me on this is that although various NGOs have condemned the use of tear gas by the Macedonians, no national government has, and there's very little current condemnation of it on the blogs. It's become almost the norm now that you use the same kind of methods against migrants as you do for riot control back home.
Well, we're going to take a short break now, and I'm sure we'll come back to that very complicated issue over the next few days. But you're listening to Maroia House, here with me, Andrew Tuck, Kathleen Burke and John Everard. Coming up next, the future of the shaky ceasefire in Syria and what might be the first ever traffic accident for a driverless car.
How much information can you pack into a minute? Every morning, the Monocle Minute wings its way into your inbox, packed with the very latest news and views from around the world, all delivered with a Monocle twist. We'll tell you what that new aircraft carrier means for Southeast Asia, why the next EU summit will be more interesting than normal, and what to look out for at an upcoming election. We'll pick out the latest retail trend in Latin America, analyse the aviation news in Australia, and take a tour of a neighbourhood that's on the up. And there's more. At the weekend, we'll review the best new restaurants, give you the lowdown on that art exhibition you've been meaning to visit, and dissect the best of the latest fashion week. See? There's rather a lot you can pack into a minute. Sign up now at monocle.com/minute.
Well, welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Kathleen Burke and John Everard. Now, the shaky ceasefire in Syria is in its fourth day, and its future seems uncertain. A senior official from Syria's main opposition has warned that the international attempt to halt nearly 5 years of fighting is in danger of collapse because of attacks by government forces. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has seemed more hopeful, however, saying that the truce is holding by and large. The UN has taken advantage of this truce, which was brokered by the US and Russia, by stepping up deliveries of food, water and medicine. John, a shaky moment, but in the end it still seems amazing. It's held as much as it has. People do seem to be generally wanting some kind of change and to maybe see an end to the fighting.
Oh, I think the wish that the fighting should stop is pretty much universal across the civilian population of Syria, almost irrespective of which of the zones you find yourself in. That it's held so far, yeah, 4 days. You can do quite a lot in 4 days in terms of humanitarian relief, and I think quite a lot of food is now getting into some of the areas where it was running very, very low, which is excellent. But really, for this to be the basis for a lasting peace, we need the ceasefire to hold a lot more than 4 days, and it's not at all clear that it is going to. Sad that through all these discussions of the mechanics of the ceasefire, no attempt so far to restart the peace talks, which of course broke down almost as soon as they started last time round. So that even if you can get people to stop fighting for an extended period of time, you've still got quite a mountain to climb to put a format together where you can work out a peace deal.
But in a way, it's a little bit of a test of everybody's kind of resolve, because if it does hold for a few weeks, if it holds for certainly longer than 4 days, then you feel that you have some kind of basis for some, at least a trust enough to kind of meet and discuss, you know, peace in a more kind of open environment than has been done before.
Well, yes, a test of their resolve. I think a test also of whether people are actually serious about this ceasefire. Some of the articles coming out, especially reports coming out from the non-Islamist opposition, suggest that neither Assad's regime nor the Russians are doing much more than using this as an opportunity to run just slightly fewer bombing raids than before. As some observers are saying, that you can't actually tell that a ceasefire is in place in some areas. So for the ceasefire to work, everybody has to take it seriously. I'm not sure they are.
Kathleen, I want to ask you about the kind of US position on this as well, because, you know, in a way it is holding because there has been some kind of understanding finally between Washington and Moscow.
But there's not a lot that the United States can do against Russia if Russia continues to do as John has described, that cutting down the bombing runs a few, but not significantly. What is interesting to me is that the news coming in that Turkey apparently is now going after bombing the Islamist areas, the ISIS areas on its border, and Russia is extremely alarmed at this. Now, does this mean we're going to have a Russo-Turkish yet again fracas breaking out in the northeast, which will take all of our tensions away from what's going on? The U.S. can only hope. I mean, you have to think, it's not only just what will win and who will lose, but what are the sanctions? What are the costs of doing anything particular thing? And what cost can the United States, John, perhaps an answer to this, what cost can the U.S. put against Russia, and the sanctions are already there, that could force them to back down if Russia doesn't want to?
This is the famous Plan B that Secretary Kerry talks about, and which he hasn't elaborated on, but which I strongly suspect involves the supply of surface-to-air missiles to the various rebel groups, not the Islamists, obviously. The United States has held back from this so far for fear that the missiles find their way into the hands of ISIS, who, of course, would have no compunction about using them against civilian airliners with possibly horrible results. But if it becomes clear that Russia is going to continue bombing, then I think the moment will come where the democratic opposition around in and around Aleppo are given these weapons, and you simply inflict such losses on the Russian Air Force that Putin stops. Remember, a lot of the aircraft that they're using are lumbering, fairly elderly ones. That they're using World War II technology, carpet bombing, a lot of places, and these are vulnerable to fairly simple missiles.
Except that they've given an awful lot of up-to-date missiles and you know, tank missiles and so forth, and anti-missile technology to Assad's forces, and if the United States doesn't give up to date, if you have two low technologies fighting each other, is that going to actually help?
But John, your feeling is that the Americans will use armaments to stop Russia in its track.
I think that might be part of Kerry's plan B, yes. It's hard to see, frankly, what other options
and
they have.
And do you think that's a threat that he will be delivering to Lavrov and to the team in Moscow? Or is that a kind of behind-the-scenes kind of, you know, manoeuvring, you would imagine?
I think the latter. I doubt if Kerry would want to hand Lavrov that card. Because, of course, as soon as you start to tell Lavrov that you might consider the supply of more sophisticated armaments to the rebels, Lavrov goes straight to the press and condemns the United States as supporting terrorists, which would play beautifully back home in Russia, which is where it really matters.
Well, we're going to finish today with the traffic news. Well, kind of. A driverless car, made by Google, has been involved in an accident with a bus. The vehicle hit a bus on a street in Silicon Valley near the company's headquarters during a testing exercise last month, it's been reported. No one was injured in the collision. I think the car was going at 2 miles an hour. But Google has admitted that it was partially responsible for the minor accident. The case is thought to be the first of its kind. Not where a car has just hit another vehicle, autonomous car, but actually where Google has claimed responsibility. I think when I was looking at the test results, there has been like some 17 incidents over time since January where Google cars have been involved. But they're saying this is the first time. It's not human error. It's the error of the car. John, much of a setback, do you think, for the world of Google? And do we care?
A huge setback? Probably not. It spoils their record. This is the first time they've had to admit that they are partially responsible. Although, in mitigation, the driver in the car, somebody who could have overridden the automatic driving system, also didn't think that the collision was going to happen. He too thought that the bus was going to give the car space to pull out. So this isn't a specific automatic self-driving car error. This is the same kind of error as we may have the human being. And clearly, people who are against self-driving cars for all kinds of reasons will jump on this to suggest that the technology is not yet ripe. A pity, as Google appeared to be in the middle of quite successful negotiations with the state of California, which would have allowed a much greater rollout of these cars. This might slow that process.
But I wonder, Kath, if you say, okay, these cars crash, a certain percentage of journeys, and if that percentage is far, far lower than those driven by human beings, then still it makes them a safer kind of option to be on our roads. So in a way, I wonder whether we should not kind of, give up on this technology just because there's been this one instance where they've said, actually, yes, it's the car's fault.
Well, they're not going to give up, are they? What they said is they're going to change their software so that the car watches out for buses or something of that sort. Well, okay, good. If I were on a California motorway, freeway, I wouldn't want to be puttering along on a driverless car at 40 or 50 miles an hour. I would want to have something a bit more powerful. I suppose, I don't know, I guess the thing is I just cannot take it seriously is my problem, and I should just turn this back over to John, perhaps.
No, but I guess the intriguing thing is, I guess we think of it as kind of a bit Jetsons, and, there'll be people tearing down the motorways. But what's more intriguing is if you're kind of a driver who suddenly hit 75, and you're not really fit to drive, or you don't have the strength, or your vision is a bit diminished, and then you've got a driverless car and you think, actually, I can get in the driverless car and tell it where to go and it can be my eyes and ears, then suddenly you give back to people who are in their 70s and 80s a kind of mobility that they imagine that's going to be stripped away from them. So on that side of it, I think for people who feel that the world of mobility may be vanishing for them, John, it might be a little bit more interesting.
Yes, absolutely. I full disclosure, I'm a great fan of driverless cars. I think it's a revolution, and I think it is a thoroughly positive one. For elderly people, Andrew, you rightly pointed out, for people who could drive but would prefer to use the time that they would otherwise have to spend driving, reading a book or catching up with the papers, sitting in the car while the car drives itself. I mean, the amount of time freed up, I think, is going to be enormous. And yes, I believe that these cars are already significantly safer than human-driven cars. And as the technology advances, I think that margin will increase. Can I just come back on one point?
You've got about 10 seconds to come back with it, yes.
Okay,
go for it.
If Google say that you have to watch out, especially if a bus comes around the corner, what about a white van driven by somebody in a black hat or anything that's got sort of flared windscreen wipers on it, the kind of lunatic cars we all recognise? Does the software cope with that?
Maybe. We'll find out in another show. The traffic news will be out tomorrow, but that's all we have time for today. John Etherard and Kathleen Burke, thank you very much for joining me here on Midori House. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Acosta Pacheco and Maria Giusti. And our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Carlotta Ribello is here with Atlantic Shift next. But from me, Angie Tuck, thank you very much for joining us today and have a good night. Bye-bye.